All right, we're going to get this show on the road on time, maximal amount of time for our speakers. So by now you guys know the gist of how this goes. I'm going to get out of the way. Buzz, you can take the floor and you can introduce yourself if you'd like to, or just move from there.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, well, good morning, everybody. My name is Fuzz Rana. I work at a ministry called Reasons to Believe, which is a science faith ministry founded by Dr. Hugh Ross. It's a privilege to be part of that team. And if I ask you this morning, what would you consider to be one of the most significant scientific insights, let's say in the last half century, that can be used to marshal a case for God's existence? What would you say? Well, if you ask me that question, I would say it's the anthropic principle. Oops. Looks like it's hit the space bar. I'm trying both. Neither's working. There we go.
There you go. Yeah.
Yep.
Just use that left click.
Well, if you ask me that question, I would say it's the anthropic principle. It's the idea that the fundamental constants and parameters and characteristics that define the universe have to be exquisitely fine-tuned in order for life to be possible. And of course, if you see fine-tuning, that suggests design. And if there's design, that suggests the possibility of a designer. But there's more to the anthropic principle than just merely the fine-tuning of the constants of physics. It's also the idea that the universe seems to be fit for a purpose. That is, the constants are such that it's anticipating, if you will, the advent of life, and maybe even, you could argue, the advent of human life. And so the design and the fitness of purpose is really what constitutes the anthropic principle. And of course, if there's an anthropic principle for physics and cosmology, I think it begs the question, do you see manifestations of that anthropic principle in chemistry and in biology? And so that's the purpose of the presentation today, is to ask the question, do you see, again, an anthropic principle in chemistry and biology? And so I'll combine those two areas and focus on biochemistry as a place to address that question. Now, one of the things that's interesting is the idea of the possibility of a biological anthropic principle actually dates back to the turn of the last century, the early 1900s. A physiologist by the name of R.L. Henderson published a book called The Fitness of the Environment. And for those of you who took general chemistry or biochemistry and you worked out how to solve the pH of a buffer solution, you'll remember the Henderson-Hasselbalch equations. Well, this is Henderson of Henderson-Hasselbalch fame. And as a physiologist, he basically argued that when you look at the properties of water and the properties of carbon dioxide, these materials have a unique set of properties that make them ideally suited to create an environment where life is possible. And so he was identifying what we now would call anthropic coincidences even before Brandon Carter in the 1960s began to explore the idea of an anthropic principle in physics and cosmology. But as far as I can tell, this idea has largely lied dormant within the life sciences until a few years ago in 1999 when Michael Denton published a book called Nature's Destiny, where he explores this question about the idea of a biological anthropic principle. And so what I'm going to be presenting today is really an extension of some of the ideas that I derived from Denton, but also ideas that ultimately trace back to R.L. Henderson. Now, one point that I want to make here is that when you seek to establish an anthropic principle in chemistry and biology, your methodology is going to be very different than it would be in cosmology or in physics. Because what happens in physics and in cosmology is scientists will essentially do a counterfactual analysis, a theoretical analysis where they will hold all the constants of physics unchanged except for one that they allow to vary. And then they'll calculate the consequences of that single changing physical constant. And so on that basis is how people discovered, again, the fine-tuning of the universe. But when you move into chemistry and biology, you cannot do that kind of an assessment. Your comparison is going to be qualitative in nature, but you're going to be doing molecular comparisons. But the advantage, I think, if there is an advantage to that approach, is that it's actually an experimental in nature, because you can do experimental comparisons of these molecular systems. So what you exchange for loss of quantitation, you gain in rigor in terms that it now becomes an experimental question. So let's illustrate that by talking about the anthropic principle as it could potentially apply to chemistry. And I'll look at a very familiar example, namely water. And I think everybody in here would understand that water is a highly unusual, highly anomalous material that also has a just right set of properties that make it suitable as a solvent system for life. And it's the anomalous properties that actually are what makes it a suitable solvent system. And so Simon Conway Morse and Ard Louis, in a book called Water and Life, said this: colorless, transparent, and tasteless, the substance we call water is ubiquitous and commonplace. Arguably, it is also the strangest liquid in the universe, with many peculiar counterintuitive properties that it is widely proposed are central to the existence of life. Water is a strange and eccentric liquid. The anomalies of water, unsurprisingly, have been recruited by those who see an intriguing, if not suspicious, fitness to purpose so far as life is concerned. And that phrase, fitness to purpose, is the clue that you're dealing with an anthropic coincidence. Now, what is it about water that makes it anomalous, but also makes it a suitable solvent for life? It's the hydrogen bonding interactions it can engage in, and those interactions are ultimately dictated by the fundamental laws of nature, the fundamental constants of nature. But the way in which you establish, again, the uniqueness of water is through molecular comparisons. And it's true that there are other solvents that have some of the properties of water, but none of the solvents that you can identify have the full suite of properties. And so Conway Morse and Ard Louis say, although many fluids are reasonable candidates in one respect or another, there is also the sense that no other fluid possesses all the properties that make water so biologically versatile. Not only does it provide a broad and flexible canvas for life to paint its multifaceted tableau, it is itself part of the palette. And so this is going to be the type of reasoning that we'll use now to try to identify the possibility of an anthropic principle in biochemistry. And what I specifically mean is this: that the molecular systems that define terrestrial biochemistry are specified by the laws of physics and chemistry, and this is in contradistinction to biochemical systems being the product of historical contingency. Okay, so this, that they're not historically contingent, but they're fundamentally specified by the laws of nature. These properties are precisely what is needed for life to be possible. And as a corollary, we would argue that the properties of terrestrial biochemistry is unique, and that is that they're not alternate biochemistries. And this is a radical statement in this day and age where people are arguing that our terrestrial biochemistry may not be universal. I'm actually going to argue that perhaps that is not correct at all. Okay, to focus on this question, we're going to look at proteins as a case study. Now, I would argue that I think there are anthropic coincidences that we would see in terms of the structure and behavior of nucleic acids with respect to the genetic code, with respect to lipids and membrane systems. I've not really thought much about carbohydrates at this juncture, but also I think you would see it with intermediary metabolism as well. But we're going to focus on proteins because, again, following after Michael Denton, he says, if the cosmos is uniquely fit for life as it exists on Earth, then given their primal significance, proteins should be another uniquely fit ensemble of natural forms. They should be specified by nature. They should be display fitness for purpose. So proteins, if you don't see a signal with proteins, you're not going to see an anthropic signal whatsoever. Now, if I had time, I could show you that there appears to be anthropic coincidences when you consider every level of protein structure: primary, secondary, supersecondary, tertiary, quaternary, and then even the way in which proteins are produced. But because of time constraints, I'm only going to focus on basically one aspect of primary structure, namely the peptide bond, and then take a look at secondary and supersecondary structures. Okay, just as a quick review, this is a cartoon showing the different levels of protein structure. The primary structure is the sequence of amino acids that are linked together to form the protein chain. The secondary structure is the conformation of the backbone. Typically, you see an alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet type structure. Supersecondary structures are not shown on this diagram, but these are the ways in which the secondary structures interact to form domains or folds. And then The tertiary structure is the three-dimensional arrangement of atoms in space. The quaternary structure is the way in which that protein will interact with other proteins to form a complex. These are the 20 canonical amino acids. Let me go back. These are the 20 canonical amino acids, the amino acids specified by the genetic code. If I had time this morning, I could show you that the R groups, which display a wide range of chemical and physical properties, actually form an optimal set. There's data that now shows that this is an optimal set of R groups in a number of different physical and chemical properties, but I'm just going to leave it at that, and instead I'm going to focus on the peptide bond. The reaction that generates basically proteins involves condensation reactions where amino acids react to produce basically what's referred to as a peptide linkage or an amide bond. So proteins are polyamides. Now, the question is this bond unusual? Is this bond unique? Well, one way that we can address that question is to look for the closest structural analog to a polymer made up of not amino acids, but again, the closest structural analog, which would be alpha hydroxy acids. And by the way, alpha hydroxy acids are produced in the Miller-Urey experiment, in fact, at higher levels than amino acids. So you would actually argue that this is a really good way to assess, again, whether or not the peptide bond is unique. And in fact, you can react alpha hydroxy acids, just like amino acids, to produce polyesters. This is the analog of alanine. This is lactic acid that can undergo a condensation reaction to form polylactic acid. There's a big difference between an ester linkage and an amide linkage. One of the big differences has to do with the bonding character. Ester linkages, are single bond in nature, and they have a tetrahedral geometry. Amide linkages have double bond character, and they have a planar geometry. And this is because of what are referred to as resonance structures that impart double bond character to the peptide linkage. Now, the fact that has a double bond character is really significant because it means it's less susceptible to hydrolysis in an aqueous environment. So right away, that sets apart amides from polyesters. In addition to that, it has a planar geometry, and because of the double bond character and the planar geometry, it imparts rigidity to the protein backbone, which allows the protein to fold into these complex three-dimensional shapes that are then going to be stable. A polyester, because it has single bond character and has a tetrahedral geometry, will form these structures that are very floppy, and they're not going to be stable in terms of maintaining their three-dimensional shape. Also, this bonding allows for what's called a transgeometry that puts the carbonyl oxygen and the hydrogen bound to the nitrogen in the peptide bond on opposite sides of the double bond, which sets these groups into the proper arrangement in three-dimensional space that allows for alpha helices and beta pleated sheets to form. In addition to that, this bonding arrangement creates what are called steric effects, which constrain what are known as the phi and psi bond angles. And it turns out that the only bond angles that are permitted are those bond angles that allow for an alpha helix and a beta pleated sheet structure to form. Banvenar and Martin, in their book Fitness of the Cosmos for Life, say this: one cannot but marvel at how several factors, the steric interactions, hydrogen bonds, which provide the scaffolding for protein structures, the constraints placed by quantum chemistry on the relative lengths of hydrogen bonds and covalent bonds, the near planarity of the peptide bonds, and the key role played by water, all reinforce and conspire with one another to place proteins in this novel phase of matter. And so on this assessment alone, it looks as if the peptide bond is a highly unusual bond, maybe even a unique bond that imparts fitness for purpose. I think this constitutes a legitimate anthropic coincidence. Okay, now let's move to supersecondary structures. And to think about this, we need to think about protein space. And the way that people would define protein space is usually in terms of amino acid sequence. So if you have a protein that's 150 amino acids in length, there'd be 20 to the 150th power possible amino acid sequences. That's a pretty vast space. But in a sense, primary structure is relatively meaningless. We really need to think about the three-dimensional structure of the protein. That is, we need to think about the way the protein folds. And for a protein that is 150 amino acids in length, there are minimally 10 to the 68 possible folds. So you're looking at 20 to the 150th power, that quantity raised to the 68th power is what constitutes protein space. But what's remarkable is there's only a few thousand folds that we've identified in proteins found in nature. And it turns out that each fold displays a wide range of function, and each fold can be attained by very different amino acid sequences. And this suggests that there are physical chemical constraints that are driving the folding of the formation of supersecondary structures. They're not historically contingent, but they seem to be specified by nature itself. And in fact, protein chemists have shown that there are topological constraints in terms of the way in which alpha helices and beta pleated sheets can interact with each other. Kothia, a very famous protein chemist, said helices and sheets pack together in one of a small number of ways. The connections between secondary structures obey a set of topological rules. Now, we can actually arrive at basically the same conclusion using an analysis by Banvanar and Martin that essentially depends only on the geometry of proteins and their hydrophobicity profile. And so what they did is they said, imagine that proteins are essentially a tube-like structure where, again, you have varying hydrophobicity along the tube profile, and that tube is going to fold in such a way to exclude water from its interior environment. And then they identify something called a folding parameter, which is the ratio of the tube diameter to the intra-tube interactions, the distance of the intra-tube interactions. And they point out, rightfully so, that if the folding parameter is large, you're going to have a fat tube that can't fold. If it's very, very small, you have like a string that can assume nearly an infinite number of folds. But there is a sweet spot where when the folding parameter is about 1, you basically get about 1,000 or so folds that are permissible. Guess what the folding parameter is for proteins? It's 1. And the folds that they get are identical to what you see in the databases. And this is a very special phase, if you will, of matter, because you have a tenuous balance between attraction and repulsion when you have a folding parameter of 1. So you could think of this as a transitional point or a critical phase. And because of this, and because there's only a few thousand folds, when proteins come off the ribosome, they very quickly can adopt their three-dimensional structure. Otherwise, they would have to explore a vast amount of space. There wouldn't be time for them to be able to fold. In addition to that, it gives you conformational flexibility, which is critical for enzymatic activity. They're robust to mutations, and it allows for a wide range of functions on that same fold by merely varying amino acid sequences. Banvanar and Martin conclude their work this way when they say the common belief is that given a sequence of amino acids with all the attendant details of the side chains and the surrounding water, one obtains a funnel-like landscape with the minimum corresponding to its native state structure. Each protein is characterized by its own landscape. In this scenario, the protein sequence is all important, and the protein folding problem needs to be attacked on a protein-by-protein basis. In contrast, our model calculations show that the large number of common globular proteins reflect a deeper underlying unity in their behavior. This landscape is pre-sculpted by general considerations of geometry and symmetry. In other words, it looks as if this too is an anthropic signal or an anthropic coincidence where you have these folds specified by nature, but they're the just right folds that allow for a wide range of protein structure and function. So what I've shown, hopefully, by just looking at limited features of protein structure, is that there does seem to be these anthropic coincidences in terms of protein structure, and that suggests, indeed, there very well could be an anthropic principle. And I'm just going to close by saying that if this is really true, this could radically change the way we think about certain problems in biochemistry. This has really profound implications in terms of the origin of life question. It has implications in terms of molecular evolution and even in astrobiology and the search for life in our solar system and beyond. And I think it also has important apologetic implications as well, because to me it's deeply gratifying to think that this idea of anthropic coincidences in physics and in cosmology actually extend into chemistry, biochemistry, and biology. That creates a unified picture of our cosmos that suggests, I think, design and purpose. Anyway, that's all I have, so I'm not sure. Is there time for some questions?
Buzz, thank you. That was really great. You can take some questions.
Yeah. Okay, Carrie.
Does this suggest that the space of available solutions is much smaller than the Doug X models?
Yes. My view on the way in which the information argument is constructed by Christian apologists has changed over the years to the point where I think it's not a very good argument. In fact, I heard Randy's talk a couple days ago, and I would agree with almost everything in that talk. So
almost.
There's a couple things, but there's probably more philosophical than anything else. Let me take a question over here. Yes, sir.
I believe that God designed the cosmos to eventually, over the course of time, using the natural laws that he instituted and sustained to produce life. This is not my forte, but what I heard you saying is not really that the cosmos is fine-tuned for life, but life is fine-tuned to the cosmos that God created. That's what I'm hearing. Is that what you're saying?
I think I would say that what we see coming out, that the nature of biochemical systems, this is the proposal, that the nature of biochemical systems is fundamentally accounted for by the laws of nature itself, and the laws of nature are the product of a creator's mind. So that the creator put in place a cosmos with the intention that life is going to be possible, and you see that reflected in the fact that what you see in protein systems, I would argue, seems to be something that's predetermined. It's not historically contingent. It's not reflecting, an evolutionary outcome, but it's prescribed by the laws of nature, where at best evolution is going to tinker with fine details. Yes. Yes, sir.
So I guess what I'm trying to frame in my mind is, how do you distinguish this from the null hypothesis that it's the space of folds you're observing, you say it's limited. It's limited with respect to it being functional in a particular context. So from that perspective, if the context is what caused it to evolve, then yes, it's going to be limited within that context. In other words, for a protein to be functional inside a cell, there's going to be a limited set of folds that are functional inside a cell. But that doesn't mean that's the limited set of folds in the whole of biology.
Well,
it's just evolved that way.
Well, I would actually argue that what the data seems to be indicating is there is a limited set of folds, period.
Random string will fold.
Yes, and they will fold into one of these limited sets. That's what I'm saying. And that's what's radical about this idea, because it's completely contrary to what I understood when I was a graduate student in biochemistry, that this is a radical idea. But I think there's data that suggests that the folds are limited, that there's not this near infinite number of folds. I think, in other words, protein space theoretically is vast, but there's only a small part that can be occupied, period. I think that's what this data, huh?
What fraction of that is functional?
Less.
Well, less would be functional, but there's also the idea, too, that this is not, if I had more time, I would develop this. There's also the idea, too, that there's a limited number of active sites that can conceivably exist, only about a few hundred. And those active sites are promiscuous in nature. And what's creating specificity are amino acid changes. But again, it's the idea that these folds actually produce active sites that inherently are functional, that within that promiscuity, they have the full range of function that you would need, and that you're selecting out that function through amino acid changes. So that's part of the anthropic coincidence, is that the folds are exactly what you need. Terry.
So I don't know if this is the same question that Mike had, but some of us aren't impressed by the anthropic principle. That, basically, it can be formulated in such a way to say given this, this right. is what you get. And so how could you get anything else?
Right.
And
well,
life,
I mean,
life has those properties because proteins have those properties, because the peptide bond and water have those properties.
Right.
And
it's, well, I mean,
it's just the only way it could be given
right.
the...
I mean, in a sense, you're bringing up somewhat the same point that Brandon Carter brought up, which is, of course, the universe is going to be fine-tuned for life because there's observers in the universe. If it wasn't fine-tuned, there wouldn't be observers to recognize that fact. And so you could interpret this in a number of different ways, theologically speaking or philosophically speaking. But I think if you are a Christian theist, this insight is fully consistent with the idea that there's a creator that's responsible for life in the same way that you would make that argument in physics and cosmology. So
I'm not impressed there either.
Yeah.
Preacher,
very well. Very well. Kurt.
This is sort of a follow-on to what Terry just said. I think what would make this more impressive and stronger is if you had something like we've got with Hoyle in cosmology, where he used the anthropic principle to predict an unknown resonance state of carbon. Then they went out and found it.
Right.
Now, do you see any way to use this biochemical anthropic principle to predict something? What direction would people look to predict something that isn't known yet?
Well, I mean, I think there's. I mean, I think there the question that was raised over here represents a place where you'd make a prediction, where you would say that they're not going to be alternate folds, or you would base a place where they're again. This is a partial presentation. There's just this recognition that the quaternary structures of proteins seem to be fundamentally specified by the laws of nature too. In fact, people have built a periodic table of quaternary structures based on really simple sets of rules. And so on that basis, they can actually now predict what they think is going to be the structures in the future that we'll discover for quaternary structures of proteins. So that's an example where you're making a prediction. And so instead of quaternary structures just being this haphazard arrangement, again, reflecting historical contingency, there seems to be an underlying law that's dictating what structures are possible. So that would be an example where people have already made that kind of prediction. So I think that the predictions are endless that would come out of this.
One more question.
Okay, yes, in the back.
Okay, I'm really happy to hear that you're saying that there's a limited number of folds in it. But I do wish that biochemists and polymer physicists and so forth would mention the word Kuhn length. That actually describes the fact that there's stiffness in the polymer. It's not a one-to-one bead-by-bead relationship, but it's a group of beads that are working together. And so this is actually half of your problem, this is part of the problem of protein folding, that there's a certain amount of reduction in the number of degrees of freedom that factors in here. I'm not in a position to make a decision on whether there's an anthropic principle, but just as a comment, actually, because you're really talking about Kuhn length here, we should get away from this and the power of, or was it the... It's 2 to the power n. It's actually something more like n over the Kuhn length factorial different conformations right. that actually exist there. Now, I'm not saying that that's complexity or this kind of thing, but we actually have completely wrong way of figuring these things, and we calculate the entropy wrong in these things too. And these are professional biochemists that calculate it that way. So this is my comment there. I do believe that God created the universe, and I do believe that God has made things wonderful. But I'm undecided on the anthropic principle myself. But thank you for your talk, and I'm glad to see that you're saying you're reducing the number of degrees of freedom. And it may actually be that I don't think that actually there are a limited number of sets. The problem is because proteins fold rapidly, very, very rapidly compared to RNA, what the problem you have is not that, but just that because they're folding rapidly, we haven't found ways to sort of tweak the thing out to more complex states.
We're going to have to carry this on after the talk.
Yep.
But thank you for coming, Swain. Let's thank Fuzz again for his support.